The topic of this workshop is finding hope after relapse. My name is Lori and I'm a compulsive eater. Our speakers for this workshop are Stacy B, Cindy W, and Judith W. Now I would like to introduce Judith.
Hi, my name is Judith and I am a compulsive overeater. And I know I'm talking to myself, but I know there's also 103 other people on the line. So hopefully all will go well. My name is Judith. I'm a compulsive eater and I live in London, UK, or just outside London, UK. And I'm just so grateful. And thank you, Sandy, for inviting me to speak. And it's just a real honor. And I used to live in Region 2 for many, many years in California and been around for about 33 years in the program. But I want to tell you this, that I relapsed 4 times, and I'm going to talk a little bit about those and why there's amazing hope on the other side of all of this. I'm here to sort of tell you, like, and to share with you the, if you're experiencing signs of relapse or you can't get back or you can't get humble, just go towards the door of admitting powerlessness. Because when I got there, I realized I'm going to have to admit powerless over everything, not just my food, everything. And to such a degree that I had to crawl on the floor and do anything that anybody said. Because this time I knew, that past time, I'd say, in 2009, when I fell off the wagon after 7 years of how away, I looked like a little princess, all that stuff. I knew I had to go for something I'd never heard of before in the program after 2 decades in program and 3 years of miserable, miserable hell breaking. Hell, I mean, it was hell, the last relapse. When they say it gets worse, it gets worse. And I knew at that point, though, somebody said, you've got to come off of that ego stuff. You're full of it and you've got to come out of it. I had to get off of the white horse I'd trailed in on. And besides, I was way too heavy for that poor horse anymore, you know? So it's a must for me, like a total must, that I must have my ego deflated. Anyway, so for me, it was as much about seeking the truth about myself as well as the lies about myself, because I have lived so many lies and so much fantasy about who I am or who I'm not or what I should or shouldn't do or could or can't and no. You know, I'm 58 years old right now. I moved back to the UK about 7 years ago. But I first walked into Al-Anon when I was married to a heroin addict. This was back in gosh knows when, and so 33 some years ago, 1987. And just to find out, right, as an Al-Anon, I was shoveling food in my face, like tons, bowing down to it like, food's my master, food's going to control this problem, food's going to fix it, I'll fix the food on Monday or Wednesday or the weekend or next wedding or whatever. But I was so addicted to overeating, as addicted to it as my ex-husband was to heroin. And I knew then I had a problem, but I never knew how bad it would get. And I know you guys, if some of you are having relapse right now, I know you're having it worse than the last time it happened. But listen, there's amazing hope in this program, right? Like, I tried it all else. I tried everything. I shot hormones in my legs with the doctors giving me like this crazy stuff to shoot in my legs and like eat 500 calories a day. And I went to therapy. I went to all of them. I couldn't do it. It didn't stay stopped. I stopped for 30 days and then I'd be back at it. But this program gives you the greatest hope, because the outcome, the result of the program of the 12 steps, and that's all it is, it's just a simple program, is to have a conscious and an unconscious spiritual experience. And that's the change that's happened to me now. In the last 7 years, I have had a shift internally that is so profound that the spiritual experience is alive now. Like, I want God, I want higher power. I want that more than the oblivion of the food and the hell it put me through, or the food, how it was fixing my life, or so my ego told me. Because I am free now, like now I can get free with the desire. Like the big book used to say, the only requirement for a membership was an honest desire. And the reality is like, honest, man, I'm going to need to get all of it ripped out of me. But now they just say you need to have a desire. But that's not the only requirement to have a spiritual awakening. It's got to be a whole lot more stuff. But I've had it enough to have a shift in the personality, a shift in my ego, the old infantile ego that's left from childhood, this feeling of omnipotence, you know, I'm it and it's all me, and frustration I can't bear, and I got to have everything now and more and better. Like, that's coming down. It's coming off the horse. Like, I'm getting connected, you know, I'm being aligned, I'm being spiritually conscious. You know, I want healthy spiritual like life. I have a spiritual personality as well as the old personality that's getting cleaned out. It's like I'm getting aligned, and it can happen. And the only way it can really happen is these 12 steps. But you have to do them thoroughly. And I had to do them at such a degree. I'd already been through gray sheet, how, everything, right? It was great to teach me how to eat. It helped. I followed it. I got life. But now I got like a new experience, a deep experience. I cherish this reality that I have now, the great reality inside me. And, you know, it can't be found out there in the food, in the shopping, or even in a meeting. It has to be found deep in here, where the highest good that loves me and is kind to me and is generous to me. Look, the hope I can offer you is this, is if you know you can't stop and no human's going to help you stay stopped forever, and you see that a higher power is helping me and the speakers today and everybody else who's relapsed before, and we get stopped, count on it, count on it. Throw away everything you think you know. I had 20 years in the program, 25 years or whatever, 22 years. And it's like, I thought I knew it all. I knew nothing. I knew nothing about the deep experience, because, you know, it wasn't enough just to get abstinent. I had to go deeper. And there is power on all fronts of your life available. And you just keep doing these steps. And why would I do these steps just once? Why, if I get that much power, then I do the steps formally every 2 years. I just do. I go back in and I see what else I need to admit. But, you know, I didn't come here feeling good. Like, no, I came into OA, you know, from a childhood that wasn't quite shaped right. I felt odd all my life and all of that stuff, you know. I felt like I was, love was confusing and all this business. Like, yeah, I was there. I had that stuff, but I didn't know that it shaped my ego, and I would need power so profound to keep this 65 pounds that of weight that was taken from me. And I didn't realize that this power would take out of me the fears that I have 70% so far, which is a miracle. I mean, I'm an extrovert, but I was an extrovert in an absolute fear factory of a body. You know, that's who I was. I know that what happened to me, the reason, you know, relapse, it goes slowly. It says things like this. I don't want to eat exactly on my plan. I don't want to weigh my breakfast. I don't want to do what my sponsor said. I don't want to pray today. You know, I got better things to do. That's what it does to me, the ego. And before you know it, I'm relapsing down slowly. Before you know it, I'm back where I was. And then I start gaining 1 pound at a time until one stone, or in our case, 14 pounds, you know, it folds on and it starts coming, and then I'm drowning in my fat, but I'm drowning in my miserable head, you know, that's where it was. And what I noticed was that I was just half-hearted. Look, I don't want to say this, that the program didn't work. I just didn't get everything I needed. I didn't work it to a fully surrendered place. I was half-hearted looking for a full desire. I had a lurking notion once I got it, I would be okay. Look, great things happened to me in the program. I had 4 years once, 7 years once, 6 years once. I mean, I had a lot of years of clean time. But I was focused so much on compliance and looking good and being included. I put my DKNY suit on, my size 6 body, and I waddled around in my cute little outfits. And actually, I wasn't waddling then because I'd lost all the weight. And I had this great life. I wrote a book. I got published. I had like more money coming in than I could ever have imagined in my career, that I, you know, for a girl with no degree, I was living it high. I had a beautiful new husband, got rid of the heroin addict, had a new husband. And, you know, we were living the California dream. And, you know, the problem was, I didn't understand. I had a threefold problem. I thought I had a physical allergic reaction to eating too much or eating certain foods. I didn't realize that I had something more. Yeah, I got it that I had a mental obsession. I didn't understand it was an illness. These were the problems, but the bigger one was dash. I did not admit life was unmanageable, even though on the outside you'd thought I had it all and you'd wanted it everything. No, in program, I was celebrating weight loss and I wasn't celebrating emotional breakthrough. People were clapping me all the way to misery. Like, it's not their fault. I showed them all of that stuff. But deep down, I was missing the emotional breakthrough that was necessary to humble me to a place where I could say, and I do each day, God, I know nothing. I know nothing. Because what I got yesterday won't help me today. I need more today. So I feel like, you know, I wasn't able to choose. I had no more power left. I couldn't say, oh, I'm going to overeat or I'm not going to overeat. That's a myth in the program. I can't choose to not overeat. I need the power. So the final relapse, it got me. It got me to clearly get it that I was insane and I was 5 minutes from locking myself up. I'm not going to say how I got out of there exactly, except that there's hope when you've had enough and when you're done there, you're done for. And so, you know, I begged for help. And what I begged the God of my understanding. I just begged out there, like, help me, I'm dying. I looked so good on the outside, even though I was so fat, I couldn't wipe my own butt anymore. I was so big, I could, it's just, and I became a person I hated. Like the person I become, the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, as the big book says, I looked so like that and inside, like, and then I'd be doing behaviors that were so nuts and crazy. But the solution written in this big book of AA, the solution is magnificent, but I forgot that Roseanne, our founder of OA, that's where she found the solution. And I went looking over all the other literature, right? I was actually there for the writing of the 12 and 12, like that's how old I am. But look, the big book, when I found I crawled back to program, I was told, read the big book. We studied that big book like our life depended on it. Now, most of that big book, this part of the big book, that is all stories. This is, that part of it is the solution, 103 pages of the solution. And 50% of that, nearly 50 of those pages are actually 50 pages dedicated. So 50 pages out of that much of the book, right? That's the solution. That is step one. And I got it for the first time that I had a life and like a life and death knowing that I had missed step one. And if you've been in relapse, you'll know you've missed step one. You haven't had the unconscious admittance to the depth of the problem. Like, and I knew I had to go there slow, steady, and sure. And what I had to do was take these, see every one of those statements. And it's like, all you got to do is take your program up a notch. And here's what I did. I took those statements, I turned them into questions. It's like I go to page XXVIII and it says, you know, my problems piled up and they became astonishingly difficult to solve. I just turn it into a question. Did my problems become so astonishingly difficult to solve on my own? Because emotional appeal was useless for people like me, a chronic addict. So I turned those questions into questions, those statements into questions and just said, so have I found that light emotional appeal to me never really gets an honest answer from me? It's never worked for me. All those statements can be turned into question. When I went into Bill's story, I turned Bill's story into my story because I can't just read the big book and say it was about a bunch of people who got sober. I got to really get the experience of a bunch of people got sober. And now I got to see if I'm like them, do I think, feel, and experience like them? And so I went through the book line by line, asking myself questions and answering those questions. And I eat like a moderate eater. Have I experienced problems from eating? Sure. But now let me go and find out. Have I become like a Dr. Jekyll, Mrs. Hyde? Show me. What are the experiences? Let's get some examples going. That's how I do the work now. I have to. I got to go deep. Because I need a deep experience and I need much more consciousness and I need this shift in my own consciousness provided by that power so much more than yesterday. So the reality is I'm willing to stay open and that's all you've got to be, honest, admit step one, take it slow and steady. I take people through, I take them 2 months into step one. I don't care what they want to do. Step one better land, because then I won't forget. Because, you know, otherwise, a friend of mine says, fear is pulling up every morning in a limousine and it says, get your button here. I'm going to drive you around all day. I love that. A guy in AA said it. It was just like, whoa, that's so true for me. So I better be having a really deep experience. I better know that step one is a real problem. Life, mental health, my mind is unmanageable. I need power to overcome fear. That's the dash. My life's unmanageable. It gets so much more manageable, but it isn't just about the fact that I weigh and measure my food. Like, that makes sense to me. I have this really clear boundary where I can't eat over. If I do, I start seeing myself get nuts. I can't do that again. I can't just have a simple belief in a power greater than me. I had to find the relationship, the sweetness, the alignment, so that I know when I'm out of alignment and when I'm in alignment, when I'm feeling the power and when I'm feeling only me. So I take it slow and steady in step one. I had to admit at utter defeat. You know, I couldn't get stopped. No, I could get stopped. I couldn't stay stopped. And I don't want to live like I'm on the edge of eating all the time. So I just want to say this. I got 4 minutes left. I'm optimistic that I crave God now more. I crave the relationship with my higher power more than I crave food. I'm telling you, it happens every day that 99.9% of my time, I am not thinking about food except when I got to get it prepped and do it. But I commit it every day to my higher power. I'm having the relationship now with my higher power, not just with my sponsor, not with the people in the program. You can check those boxes. I can check all the boxes. I checked them before when I was down in the 20 years in program. Yes, I went to meetings 3 weeks, times a week. Yes, I read the No, my meditation is not about reading a meditation in the ODAT and saying, check. No, my meditation is about, take me, God, into the unfamiliar. Help me to be quiet and pause now. Half an hour in the morning, I pause. I need to be so out of my mind that God can get in it. Because I know, and I pray to God each day, don't let that great obsession tell me today that I can do it tomorrow, because I will forget the pain. I will guaranteed forget that pain. But now I get this new thing, which is I sense that I'm being cradled. I sense that something has got me, this love, this power, this whole body experience. It's like, it's calming. I can rely on it. It is my ease and comfort. And so I say to God each day, you know, I take so much of our literature and I turn it into prayers, like that wonderful pamphlet that was put out before you take that first compulsive bite. For me, that's an entire set of prayers now. Dear God, please don't let me, not even for a split second, think about fantasize or imagine what it's like or might ever be like again to eat the way I did, to eat the foods or to eat more today. Help me to remember you are the most delicious, sweet, juicy, gooey, yummy, yummy, yummy thing I could ever want. Just help me stay there. And please, God, don't let me not for a split second think that it's a mean injustice or unfair that I can't have a treat like normal people. I'm not normal. I'm never going to be. If I need a treat, then I must be feeling separation from you. Help me get back to alignment, to connectedness, to being just here, just now, with enough pause. And so when I'm irritated and agitated and doubtful, I've got prayers. They're all in the big book. The big book tells me exactly how to live now, how to be. And so I pray in the morning and I pray all day and I stay connected and I step 10 my behavior all day long. At night, I do my personal inventory. You know those things. I'm not going to bore you. I do all of them. And I know this, that when they talk to me about a higher power that had to be personal, even my atheist husband knew, and he even said it to me, that when I was in the depth of my last misery, please God, he said to me, honey, you have to find a God power, like powerful, but personal to you. And as the big book says, I have found the power that is love and that is truth and it's care. It's superhuman, meaning it is way more than any human can tell me. If I have a problem, always my guide says to me, stop, take it to God, because the great reality is in here. This highest consciousness of highest good, it's in here. Throw yourself out there into this program. Go for the great universal truth. And for me, all the lies got peeled off. the lie about how I have to control my life or fix you or fix me, how I have to believe this or that that was true about my life before, but it isn't now, or old beliefs about my life that I can't keep going on with. The pain I caused myself is over. So this is a whole body experience now. And I feel the ease and comfort. I feel the confidence, the reliance. And I put that in the power of my higher power, not just in the program that gets me there. And with that, I'll pass. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Judith. That was amazing. And now I'd like to introduce Cindy W.
Hi, everybody. My name is Cindy, and I am a compulsive eater from California. And thank you so much for having me. I'm so grateful to be here. I'm also very emotional. This topic of relapse is really something that I hold like so dear to my heart. You know, it makes me want to like tear up just thinking about it. And I've been in this program for almost half my life, and I never stopped coming back. And I've always felt that I was born a compulsive eater because I've never known a time in my life where food was not the most important thing in my life. Food was everything in the world to me as a child. I had a lot of mixed emotions about food. I was from this really big, loud Italian family. We loved to eat, but we also loved to try and control our kids' food. So, you know, I had parents and grandparents, you know, always trying to throw food at me and then trying to put me on a diet. And that was my childhood growing up. But all I knew as a child was that no matter how much food there was, and there was a lot of food, food was just very plentiful in my house. So it's not like I was really deprived or anything, but I just knew from a very young age that I was bodily and mentally different from my fellows, and that no matter how much food I had, it was never enough. And it seemed to be enough for other people. You know, and I remember stories my mom telling me as a very, you know, probably a baby still, that I would just scream and throw tantrums, and she would try and offer me money and just like beg me to stop eating. And no matter what, I just could not stop eating. And I went to my very first meeting when I was 12. I was not emotionally or mentally ready to accept anything that this program had to offer. But, you know, God works mysterious ways, and the seed was planted in my brain, and I never forgot about Overeaters Anonymous. And, you know, my whole life, I was trying to control my food. I was never a good dieter. I could never stop eating long enough to put the food down to lose any amount of weight. And when I was 23, I had just started a diet, and that diet became my first abstinence. And it just like suddenly crossed my mind. And today I know that that was God. Why don't you try OA again? And I went to my very first meeting besides that one when I was 12, and I was about 23. I just gotten married. I was very ashamed of it. I remember lying to my then husband and telling him some made up story where I was going. I walked into my first meeting, and I knew I was home. And this is just another way for me to feel like I was like there's something different about me, because that meeting was very dark. It was like full of like, it wasn't like joyful and laughter and happiness that I know today to be Overeaters Anonymous meetings. It was, you know, death and dying and stories of awful things happening to people. And it was exactly what I needed, you know, at that time, because I was 479 pounds when I walked in. I was 23 years old, and I was having heart palpitations. I had chest pains. And there were times when I was very young that I remember, like one Christmas Eve, like being bent over, my chest hurt so bad. I was absolutely convinced that I was having a heart attack, and I was begging God to make it stop. And I would, you know, lose weight and keep it off for the rest of my life. And the second the pain stopped, my promises went out the window. And, you know, this illness, this food thing is just so cunning and so baffling and so powerful that God himself could have come down and told me, if you take one more bite, you're going to die right now. And I was powerless to do anything about it. You know, that is like the epitome to me of like powerlessness. No matter how bad I want to stop, no matter what's at stake, I've left my sleeping baby in her crib to go get food. I've broken toilet seats off of walls. And I'm talking like an actual toilet, not just like a broken toilet seats too, I'm sure, but I actually broke a toilet seat, an actual toilet off of a wall in a public bathroom and just fell to the floor and was in water. And just pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I had high blood pressure, heart palpitations, diabetes, you name it. I could not walk up a flight of stairs. I was physically, mentally, and spiritually dead inside when I came to these rooms. And, you know, it just tears me up because there's so much hope here. And just the meaning of this whole convention being hope, it's been so beautiful. And I just want to share real quick, I think, so this is a couple pictures, hopefully you guys can see them, of me when I was really heavy. This one is the one picture that I have at my very top weight, which was 479 pounds. And I couldn't hold down a job. I didn't know how to live in this world. I got fired. You know, it's hard to concentrate on work when your mind is full of food. And I want to read a couple pages from the Big Book, because the Big Book is my instruction manual for life. And the Big Book is, to me, has the answer to every problem that I've ever had. If the Big Book teaches me that the problem is me, and as long as the problem is me, there's a solution. If the problem is you, there's no solution. And that's the beauty of this program. And no matter what you did to me or what I perceive you did to me, as long as I focus on that, there's never going to be a solution. And my very favorite passage in the Big Book, I think, is on page 8, where Bill W. says, "No words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity, quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I've been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master." And that is exactly how I feel with food. When I'm in the food, no matter what the food asks of me, I will do. I will put aside my morals, my standards, my ethics, my parenting. I love my daughter with all my heart. I love other people with all my heart, but I will put them in jeopardy to get my next bite, because that's what this disease does to me, you know. And it talks about fear sobered me for a bit. And I remember so many times that fear sobered me for a bit. And then at one time I had a major surgery, and the doctor actually looked me in the eye and he told me, "When you come out of the surgery, because you're so big, you might not be able to breathe on your own. You might have to have a ventilator." And I was able to breathe on my own, but I did have a lot of complications. It was a very simple surgery for someone who wasn't 479 pounds, but because I was, I had complications, and I was in the hospital for like 9 days. And I will tell you, because I could not eat for 9 days, and put a compulsory eater in the hospital, terrified, unable to eat for 9 days, I wanted to die. I mean, I honestly did. I didn't want to see anybody. I was in so much physical and emotional pain, and I could not mask it with the food. And my whole point to that story is that on my way home, I stopped at a buffet. Fear sobered me for a bit, but it doesn't have depth and weight, and it isn't enough to stop someone like me from overeating, you know. And he also talks about, "I woke up, this had to be stopped. I could not take one more drink. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk." And that was the story of my life. I made so many promises, and promises that I really, really believed too. So that's like the insidiousness of this illness too, is that we believe our own lies, or I believe my own lies, you know. And when I come from a place of that deep dark, I want nothing but the food. The food is all that matters to me in my life. This addiction, it's physically, emotionally, and it's spiritually, and nothing matters but the food. And today I have like this most amazing life that I can't even put into words. Physically, I've lost over 260 pounds and I can walk up a flight of stairs today. One time I like just ran on the beach just to see if I could. Like, it was such a beautiful moment. And I always tell people that that's the smallest gift that this program has given me. And I really mean that with all my heart. I was in a really bad marriage. By the way, when I had my daughter, I was like this married woman. This should have been the most beautiful experience of my life. The doctor looks at me and she's like, "What do you want to do? Do you want to have this baby?" Like, she was kind of talking to me like I was like a knocked up 14-year-old, you know, and I still remember that to this day. And then I said, "Well, yeah, of course I want to have it. I'm a married woman. Like, this should be a beautiful experience. And she proceeded to tell me all the many things that could go wrong with me and my baby. And she terrified me so much that I went out of that hospital sobbing. And this disease robbed me of this beautiful, beautiful moment in my life, you know? And it's taken jobs for me. I have this journal that I like to share at meetings because, you know, I will say that I've been in this program for over 20 years now, and I never, ever, ever stopped coming back. I got abstinence immediately. Like I said, that first abstinence was my diet that became my abstinence. I worked the program the best I could by myself. I didn't have a sponsor. I read the literature and tried to do what it said. I worked the steps, but they're not the steps they work today. But it was enough somehow to keep me abstinent for a year, and I lost 130 pounds really, really quickly. And to this day, I really believe that was God keeping me here, because if I would have went to this program and just couldn't get it, I would have probably been like, oh, this is just another thing that doesn't work. But because of that initial abstinence, you know, I relapsed after that, but I knew that there was something beautiful in this program that I had never experienced anywhere else. And that was my first taste of hope. And back to that very first meeting where it was so dark and everything, I felt at home. You know, I didn't even feel like, oh my God, these people are crazy. Like, this is so scary. It was like, oh my gosh, this is beautiful. And I remember this woman running after me, and she was like, please come back next week. They're not all like this, which just shows me again that I'm different, because an average person probably would have been scared to death. But here I am like, no, this is beautiful, because that is exactly what I needed to hear. I needed to hear the message of I'm going to die, because that's where I was at. And today I get to share the message of hope that I get to live. And I've had many struggles within the past years and months, and today I have problems, but food is not one of them. I have freedom. I have so much freedom. Like, I have food in my house that to me, it's like it might as well be cardboard. I wanted to eat a piece of cardboard, and I wanted to eat that. Those things I haven't eaten in 7 years. And the beauty of this program is not even that I'm able to abstain, but that I don't even want the food. That is true freedom to me. And at one point in my recovery, I was kind of seeing myself go down that road again, because I know from experience that the food is the last to go. So I'm very diligent keeping in my mind, this could be my last recovery, but it also could not, you know, and I don't ever want to go back to that hell for anything. And at one point I saw myself slipping down that road, and I made this list, and I keep it in my journal of what this disease has taken from me. And it's taken my dignity, you know, being on the floor in a public bathroom, breaking a toilet seat off the wall, like, talk about dignity being stolen. You know, a normal childhood and teen years, I used to go to school dances as a teen, and I would write from like boys to myself in my yearbook, so people would think that someone wanted to dance with me. That is so sad. I lost a job because of this disease. My self-esteem, my self-respect, my serenity, and my freedom, everything gone in like a split moment. And I know that it could be gone in a split moment again. A stable home life, you know, I don't have enough time to share what it was like really, but I was in a really bad marriage that was abusive on both sides, verbally, not physically, but it was abuse still the same. And, you know, I've been in and out of homeless shelters with my daughter many, many years. You know, I was in this relationship that I couldn't get out of, and I just kept going back, and I kept making bad decisions, because this disease takes away my ability to make a decent decision for myself, for my family, the ability to be a good parent, employee, partner, friend. And then I wrote, if I relapse, I can still lose all these things again, including my life. And then on the other side of that, I made this other list, and I read these whenever my program isn't what I think it should be. And it's a good reminder what this program has given me: healthier relationships and a more loving, stable home. It's funny because I was in that relationship that I didn't even know it was bad until I found one that was truly loving and kind. And today I'm in a relationship with another woman in this program, and it's the most beautiful relationship that I've ever been in. And we have a great life together. You know, I have a great job, and I have financial security more than I've ever had it. I've lost, like I said, over 260 pounds, and that is by far the smallest gift I've ever received. I got back my dignity and my self-respect. I have amazing friendships and a fellowship, an overall feeling of peace and joy in my heart. There are things that happen in this world that, like, the joy and peace that I feel has nothing to do with outside circumstances. Like, without this program, I don't want to get out of bed in the morning times. But with this program, there is just a peace and a joy, and it's God-given. It's like it has nothing to do with anything outside. I can truly love and enjoy life today, and I can truly live, and I have a purpose and a usefulness in life. And I wrote here, too, what am I willing to do to keep and honor these gifts? Because these gifts, they are truly gifts, and I have to protect them. And all I have to do is show up here every day and turn my will and my life over to this beautiful God of my own understanding, you know? And it's like, however I feel about God, it's like any higher power that took away my food obsession, took all this weight off my body and gives me a meaningful, joyful, and peaceful life today is a higher power that I'm more than willing to give my will and life over to every day. And this program is so beautiful. Like, I was listening to the talent show last night where they were doing the Brady Bunch thing with the OA Bunch, and I just started sobbing, and my partner looks at me and she's like, why are you crying? It's funny. And it was just, I can't explain it, you guys, but it's like being in this program with you, it's the most touching, just knowing that we're all in this together. Like, I don't even know you guys, you know, I can, to this day, I can sit in a room full of like my cousins and my second cousins and extended family and feel like strangers, but I sit in the rooms with you amazing people. I don't even know people, and I feel like we're family, and it's the most beautiful gift that I could ever get. To be able to, you know, I talked about not having a purpose, and I have my purpose today, and my purpose is to carry this message of recovery. I went through the idea of possibly getting skin removal surgery at one point. And you know what? Three different people, and I love to share this at meetings, three different people, strangers on the street, came up to me and asked me how I lost weight based on how my skin looks. And, you know, I decided that this is just my battle scars, and this is just how it's going to be. And if that's a way for me to carry the message, if that's God's will, then I'm fine with it. You know, who cares? I have some skin hanging. It shows me what I've been through, and it shows me what I can go back to as well. And I'm going to end real quick because I love this. This is from page 16 in Voices of Recovery, and I think it's perfect for this workshop. Those of us who live this program don't simply carry the message, we are the message. Each day that we live well, we are well, and we embody the joy of recovery. The 12 and 12 of OA, page 106. When I first walked into the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous, I was like the candle whose light is flickering and close to going out. I was sick in mind, body, and spirit. I was hopeless. Many OA members describe OA as the last house on the block. I do not know if that's true, since I don't know where the block begins or ends. I do know that what I found at OA can be found only in the heart and mind of another recovering compulsive eater. The flickering light that I came in with became stronger, and the hopelessness turned to the hopefulness. I can be a living example or a dying example of how the program works. My courage to recover and my experiences in OA serve as an example to those who know me. I represent and carry the message of hope. And I almost was a dying example of how this program worked. There is no logical reason why I should be alive today. There is nothing that I can come up with in my own brain as to why I'm not dead. The only reason I have is that there is a power greater than myself working in my life, and that I get to experience being a living example to bring hope to other people. And that is my purpose, and that is what I hope to represent today and for the rest of my life. And I'm so honored to be here. So thank you guys for letting me share.
Thank you, Cindy W. That was amazing. And now I'd like to introduce Stacy B.
I'm Stacy. I am, as my sponsor taught me, you know, in the big book, I'm a real compulsive overeater, as are the ladies that just went before me, it sounds like. I am mentally and bodily different from my fellows. One of the sayings I love on there when I think about picking up sugar again is that part in the big book where it says, I'm a woman who's lost a leg. I can't grow a new one. I'm never going to grow a sugar leg or like the ability to eat like a lady. I just was so hyped up. I just wanted to take a moment and just kind of be prayerful about, you know, if you're at this session, there's a good chance that you're experiencing relapse. And oh, I look at the flowers above my head here. My daughter picked those. And to be in relapse and to be here is nothing short of a miracle to me. The flowers and the light, it's a miracle. And you may be eating right now, because that's what I've done too. Like, I'll go to the conference, but usually I would leave and eat. So, you know, you can just eat while you're watching Zoom. I'm not trying to be funny. It's how the disease works for me. And so I wanted to start with this prayer. I'm looking at my computer because I have program things taped all over it. Also a rubber chicken, because I was taught in the program, what's that one part that says, we insist on having fun. We're not a glum lot. And so someone said, you got to have a rubber chicken. So I have that. This reading is from the 12 steps and 12 traditions. I have it on here at the end. Some words I'll emphasize because this is so true for me. I'm trying to think, have I been in relapse more? No, overall, I've been in recovery more than relapse. I've been here 33 and a half years. Started when I was 2. No, I'm 55. And I think I look great. I love myself today. This weight, letting my hair go gray. I have half an eyebrow, which I didn't fix for you guys. It's gone inside out. This weight in the past would have been unacceptable if I'm eating, if I'm putting that stuff in my body, the self-hate doesn't matter. This little prayer I have here, I pray for the willingness to remember that I am a child of God, whatever you choose, God, good orderly direction, love, I like, spirit of the universe, a divine soul. I am, you are a divine soul in human form. And my most basic and urgent life task is to accept, know, love, and nurture myself. As I accept myself, I'm accepting God's will. As I know and love myself, I'm knowing and loving God. As I nurture myself, I'm acting on God's guidance. And here's the part you might want to write down. I pray for the willingness to let go of my arrogant self-criticism and to praise God by humbly accepting and caring for myself. Arrogant self-criticism, you know, the flip side of ego. I loved what Judith was talking about. It's hard sometimes. You get abstinent, you lose weight, you're happy. And I love that, being too heavy for her white horse. The other side of ego is arrogant self-criticism. If I'm in relapse, it means a few things. Number one, it means I belong in this program. I'm suffering from a life-threatening disease. And it's got me by the neck again. It doesn't mean not taking responsibility or whatever. I hate, God, all the times I was in relapse with bulimia. Don't tell me how to stop, or, you know, like put the fork down, or that, you know, that I'm not thinking about it 24/7. I'm thinking about it day and night. I hate myself. I want to die. That's when I become suicidal. That's arrogant self-criticism, and it's part of the disease. And I'm here to say, I'm just going to assume, you know, if you're not in relapse, you've been in relapse, you want to watch out for relapse. What has helped me the most? I have a list, because I often will get going and I won't say some of the important things. And I want to tell you what's really helped me. I did come in 1987, started binging. Well, I have a little poem I found the other day that I wrote when I was like second or third grade. I'll read it fast. I was very little then. I was only one. All the children on my street said I weighed a ton. But then I turned 2 years old. All the grown-ups said I was bold. But that was very long ago, because I was only little then. When I was 3 and very wee, nobody wanted to play with me. So, you know, sometimes you think, God damn it, you know, I'm Well, the last time I relapsed, I was 48, 49. It was about 6 years ago. My daughter, my beloved daughter, who has type 1 diabetes, which I blame myself for, pregnancy, all the whatever. I don't blame myself. I'm just aware of the ramifications of this disease. She was cutting herself. She knocked holes in the wall. Her diabetes was out of control. There's never a good excuse, but I threw up again. So my disease says, again, you're the queen of relapse. Here you are. You've been in program for whatever it was at that point, 26 years or something. It means that I belong in this program. I'm having another experience. And it's not, oh, I know. The reason I brought this little letter up is this isn't new. This isn't like I'm done or I'm fixed. This is, I don't remember starting to feel fat and hating myself in that way until I think it was fifth and sixth grade when I started to look fat. This is not, I couldn't even spell in this, you know, this is ancient. This is ancient. You know, bless my little self. All the kids said I weighed a ton. So now I'm there. Now I'm, you know, 5 years ago, my last relapse. So now I'm in the craving. And I get that part of what got me there is failure to continue my conscious contact with higher power. You know, I know that stuff. It's not that pertinent right now. I mean, I can pray to God. I prayed, you know, what did they call it? Like the porcelain bus, driving the porcelain, you know, I promise I won't do it again. I'm throwing up blood. My heart's stopping. I think I'm going to die. I'm at a Conoco station kneeling in shit. I promise God. Yes, God's there. I am in craving. And so what? One thing I was told that really helps, this is part of my list. I was told it's about step one until it's not about step one. It's either step one or it's 2 through 12. It doesn't mean it's, you know, I'm powerless every day. But if you just threw up last night, if you're eating right now, if you still have stuff you need to get rid of, I'm in craving. And I love this definition of craving, which is helpful. Craving is that which cannot be satisfied. Can't be satisfied. Because, you know, for me, I would sort of like, well, let me get this and this and this. Also, let me hurt myself so badly that will raise the bottom and then I'll stop. All these things that we do. Craving is that which cannot be satisfied. So I love what was said about the doctor's opinion, the disease, more about alcoholism. Super important to really get into that and look at that again and understand this is an allergy. This is a disease. My cancer is out of remission. Okay. Not a moral issue. Yes, I hope to do better next time. I promise I'll meditate. Right now, I want to kill myself. Also, I don't want to go back in and tell people. One of the things being in relapse many times helped me is I'd have this thing. It would come in my head. It would say, oh, you want to like not tell your best friends that they've cried on you. You've cried on them. You've been to 800 meetings with them. You don't want to tell them that you overate, which is why you're all at the fucking meeting. You know, like you, like, would they going to be like, oh, you know, we always knew you were the fatty that couldn't get it. Or whatever. No, that's the last house on the block. And what I know is when someone is honest in a meeting and says, when I was in law school, I was in relapse and I went to a 7 a.m. meeting and there were times it was 7 a.m. It was dark in San Francisco. Nobody let you use a bathroom. I was already binging. I'd throw up in the park across from this church. I would wipe my hands on the grass and I would walk into that meeting because that's my place. And I always thought, I often had this thought like, people are tired. You might have this thought, you might not, and I'm the only one in the world. You might be thinking, yeah, that's well and good, but I've been in relapse before. And, you know, there's a time limit and people are sick of hearing about it. No, when I go in a meeting and someone tells the truth, a sponsee just told me something about the other night, I just think my little heart grows, you know, like the Grinch at the end. The program I've been told in that room, if I bring happiness, it expands and you all are like, yay, you got the job. If I bring my pain, you all take it and make it smaller. And that's how I feel. It's a privilege. Now I know that, but this is how I felt in relapse. I have trouble with time because I'm so excited to talk. So I'll look at some of the things. Okay, one thing that, here's just some of the things I wrote down. It actually helped me to hear that just stuck in my brain for whatever reason. Just because you dented the car doesn't mean you need to total it. What? You know, like I got to finish. I'm bad. I'm da 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 da. Just because you dented the car doesn't mean you need to total it. And it's helpful. It helps me to maybe stop, throw something away, call somebody. I never understood how people do that. Or just throw it away. And then I'll tell the truth next week. You know, I'm not the greatest truth teller. I don't like run right out right away. But I'm saying that really helped me. The other thing is about first step and then it's 2 through 12. I was told this in San Francisco that you can't redecorate a burning house. That makes sense because I'm a fucking burning house when I am, you know, man, you know, I've had, you know, my husband find my icing under the bed that was from a relapse, you know, that was like a year ago. And then he's under there with something. And then he's like, pulls out this icing. That's when I'm in that burning house. I mean, yeah, go ahead and meditate. Go ahead and do your 10th step, do all that stuff. I need to come back and recognize craving. And I'll tell you something that helped me too, is my daughter's middle school, though. You walk into the nurse's office and she had this display and it was fascinating. It was a big cardboard thing and there's therapists that help people. And of course, lots of people are struggling with food and alcohol and sex in high school. This thing had little baggies of, it looked like crack, and they were different sizes and they were baggies of sugar. And above each baggie was Wheat Thins or Snickers bar, or I don't know, like a sweetbread or something. And under it were different sized baggies of sugar, which again, looked like heroin or crack. That has stuck with me because it's like, that is my drink. It's alcohol to me. I'm 33 and a half years sober too, but my food has always been worse. When that goes in my mouth, it goes in my blood system. I actually slur on the phone with sponsors if I've been eating sugar. You know, of course I make poor decisions and I can't stop. It's that which cannot be satisfied. So how do I stop? I put myself in ICU. It's Stacy's ICU. It's fully insured. Don't have to deal with the whole insurance problem. I got to put myself in ICU. I got to do my most basic and urgent life task is to accept, know, love, and nurture myself. Extreme self-care. And what that looks like for me, and you, this is just Stacy's program, what has worked for me, it came to me years ago, I have a target, like for archery, and that very middle target, what's going to kill me fastest? What am I craving that I cannot stop? Well, for me, it is bulimia first. So keeping down, no matter what went in, I had to keep that shit down. And some things, you know, things of food, I'm not supposed to cuss probably or say foods. So I'll try not to, but that was my first target. And if you're bulimic, I've got news for you. In my experience of many years, I'm probably going to binge again, you know, because if I'm bulimic and I'm going to stop, I think, oh, okay, I got to not do it again. Well, you know what? I would always binge again. Most bulimics I know. Well, then what? Well, keep it down. I got to keep it down or I'm never going to get out of that bulimia. That's the center of my target. I have almost 6 years from bulimia. After 33 years in this program, a couple times I had 2 years right before law school. I've had 1 year a couple times. I almost have 6 years. Oh my gosh, and I'm almost done. Okay, here's the things that helped me. 90 and 90. Zoom, 890. Meetings. And then my abstinence is, if I'm getting off of sugar, I tell people things like frozen blueberries and plain yogurt. If you're going to binge, eat a big old carton of that. Just don't go to the hardcore sugar. So I have sort of a methadone program. Again, it's what's worked for me to get out of relapse. I don't eat that stuff right now because I've been abstinent a while. So methadone foods, fruit, that kind of stuff. Abstinence, when I'm in relapse, I choose one thing I can succeed at. I said years ago, it just came to me, I cannot go from binging to broccoli. I have tried. If I have a hard day now, I go buy a bunch of vegetables. Still, I cannot go from binging to broccoli. What can I start with? Well, don't eat crack. Eat, you know, a bunch of fruit to get, you know, 10 days away from sugar. That's what works for me, that target. So God will give you a window. It might be this conference. I bet it is. God gives us a window. We put our finger through, we put our fist in, we put our elbow, we put our ass in there, and we go to 90 meetings and we tell everybody, I've been in relapse. We get partners in recovery. That's five. My sponsor said it's a basketball team, one half of the basketball team, not just your sponsor. Who's your partner in recovery? That's who you tell the truth to while you work up the gumption to tell your sponsor. This is just Stacy's program, and I'm just being real. I got to tell somebody. I need little people. Also, definition of a bottom. When things get worse faster than you can lower your standards, that means there is no bottom, maybe. So I don't get to wait until I'm ready to get out of relapse. I have a disease that tells me I don't have one. It was told to me, you may not want to. Let's hope you don't die first. You don't have to want to and be ready. Okay, it means you can lower your standards like that, like shitting on yourself when you're at your work, like I did in my law office. 90 and 90, something to succeed at. Wear loose clothes for God's sake. You can do that now. Self-acceptance. You know, God is there. I think that that's it for me. When I finally got off sugar, I really got the first step. One of the things that helped me is I really, really know there's not enough. I don't know I knew that before. There's not enough in the world. When you are off whatever you're on for 10 to 21 days, you know this because it's happened before. It will lift. The beautiful people you see in abstinence, they're not laboring under craving. Nobody could do it if we were. It will lift. So, you know, God bless you. Keep coming. I never left. That's what you can do perfectly. And I'm so glad everyone's here. Thank you.
Stacy B., thank you so much. That was wonderful. We will now open the floor for a question and answer session. So I'm going to just throw these out to you guys. There's some real easy ones. All right. Relapse is not part of my story, but it is for many of my fellows and sponsees. I'm not always sure how I can best help someone in relapse. Any thoughts?
Judith, I'll jump in on it. I don't think you have to worry about whether you have this exactly the same experience about relapsing or not relapsing. If you haven't relapsed, this is good news. Then perhaps something spiritual has occurred for you, and that you have some message and you have an awakening. As long as you've had some kind of psychic shift, some kind of awakening, you have something to share. If you have a deep, profound, and clear, concise message that you can bring to this person, it really doesn't matter. They may be able to talk. I always tell my sponsors, you must create a village around you. So yeah, maybe it's nice. I like to talk to these women who've had relapse, but the reality is you just do what you got given and, you know, they'll get it. Hopefully. If not, they'll need to go lower, but that's okay.
Thanks, Judith. There are a couple of people that are asking for Stacy's prayer. Can you please ask for Stacy's prayer? And then Lori H says, Stacy, where can I find your opening prayer?
Oh, let's see. Shall I type it in the chat while someone else is talking next? And then the like wizards of this can do something. Does that work?
That sounds good.
Okay. I wanted to say one thing about if for me, sometimes I've heard that last question. I don't know why or where. Sometimes people get fired if they're relapsing or something. And I have one rule, which is you can show up for our weekly hour and 15 minutes to read the big book. Abstinence is the gift and a result of recovery. So we do the things we can do. And so if you got fired or let go for that just is, so I'd never do that as a sponsee or a sponsor. But if someone stops being able to do the work, then we have the talk, which is it's not good or bad, but it seems like there's a willingness issue. I'll always be here, but I need a new sponsee.
Okay, and then Cindy, what page did you refer to from, was it for today or was, I think it was Voices, or maybe you referred to both.
It was actually page 16 on Voices of Recovery, so January 16.
All right, and Judith, can you speak a little more about having a conscious or unconscious spiritual experience?
Thanks, great question. I look around in the big book and see who inspired the people, whether before or after they wrote the first edition and the second edition of the big book. And I follow the lead to find out what influenced Bill Wilson and the others. And some of that was work around the act of surrender and the ego. And so for my learning, that the conscious unconscious, the defiance and grandiosity that makes up the infantile ego. I'm not talking about the ego that tells me what is useful and not useful, but the infantile ego, that is that part left over from childhood that defies reality and thinks it knows best, right? That's a child, right? You ever had a 2-year-old or a 5-year-old or even a 12-year-old, certainly a 14-year-old. But the reality is, though, is I can come to meetings, I can go to 90 meetings, I can do all of that, which I did, but I was submitting to the program and doing it, but I hadn't had this deeper. So consciously, I knew if I did what you told me and I do it well, and you know, I can accept the reality. So I know for 20 years in program, I did accept that I was a compulsive eater. I really got it consciously. What I hadn't yet had was the demoralizing level to demonstrate to me at such a gut experience, because I kept thinking there'll come a day and I'll be okay. Well, there is no day. I'm not normal. I'm never going to be. I suffer from a mental illness of obsession and a craving that is absolutely guaranteed if I put those things or more in my body. But it's not dependent on that. The struggle, when I just consciously submit to the program and I comply, the struggle is still on, the tension is still on. Hence, there was a lot of white knuckling, or even when white knuckling wasn't going on, it was still there a minor amount of defiance and grandiosity. When that gets cleared, like it takes something deeper. It takes a level of unconscious knowing that I am licked. I loved it, Cindy, that you read from Bill's story. And it's like, take Bill's story and write your story next to it, right? 97 times or what it was, I clearly identified with Bill. And when I identify with Bill, and I got it at such a gut horrible level, that I am as grandiose as Bill was, and I am as defiant as Bill was, and I could be doing that through people pleasing, making you want to like me, looking good, all that stuff. But there was a persistence, like a capacity for persistence of thinking, but one day you'll see, I'll be on top of this. But when you get down and you see yourself in this big book, which if you have it come alive, don't just read it with someone, really turn it on yourself as a thing. Suddenly it was an active experience I was having. And it floored me, floored me. And believe me, I was a year and a half cleaned up again when I went in and I went deeper, and it floored me at how much capacity I still had for denying reality. But once you get there to such a it's demoralizing, it's horrible, but it's like it's an active place where suddenly your unconscious says, I'm done, I'm licked, it's over. Then we have, then we start to get this new experience, right? This new possibility come in, and surrender starts to happen. I'm done, I'm done. And when people say to me, what do? I just can't want to eat again on Monday. I'm like, it's okay, honey. You're not done. It's okay. We love you. You're not done. Come to meetings, shut up and listen. Like that kind of love, you know, you got nothing to say. Go talk with people before and after meetings, you know, but it's like people come and it's like, it's all right. The surrender is not there. I was there. I could not surrender until the internal shift occurred and I was done. Does it mean you can't work the steps? No, but go back in them. If you know, there's this hovering defiance and grandiosity still there. It's okay. We keep diving deeper because the ego will surrender, be surrendered. But at that moment when the unconscious starts happening, I knew that God had a chance because I feel like the higher power never left me. It was always in me. The higher consciousness was always within me. And at that moment, its voice got louder than my ego. I knew I will never have a day where I become normal and I can do it again tomorrow. There isn't another day. So hopefully I pray for you, or you pray for yourself, that that happens, because it's a beautiful moment of unconscious surrender.
Thank you. I have a question. Do you have any warning signs that a relapse is nearby? Can you catch yourself from the relapse before it gets out of control?
I'm Cindy, compulsive eater, and for me, like I said, food is the last to go. So that I've had many times that I've caught myself going down that path, and I've never in my life woken up. I've never in my life, like, you know, Friday had like a perfect abstinent day, was very spiritual, worked my program, and then Saturday there was a donut in my mouth. Like that just does not happen. I heard recently a speaker talk about how when we work the steps, we do them in order, you know, 1 through 12. But when we relapse, we go through the opposite order. And I feel like that's the truth. Like it starts where I'm not carrying the message as much. And my sponsees, it's all in my attitude too. Like my sponsees will start irritating me. And like I'll dreading their phone calls, you know, rather than being like, oh, thank God I have a sponsee that's calling me and how grateful I am for that. And then I'll be, you know, resting on my laurels with my nightly review. And when I'm agitated or doubtful, I don't pause. And, you know, and then I'm not doing my 10 steps and things are just getting to me more and more. And I've had many times in the last 7 years, at least a handful of times where I've caught myself. And that's that list that I read was actually at a point where I was really terrified that I was going to relapse again. And that's what came out of that because of that. And I just think that I have to be really diligent. Everything that I know, I have to be really diligent working my program every day, making this program the center of my life. Because when I start saying or even thinking things like I don't have time for X, Y, Z, that's the problem. I've never woken up one day and thought, I don't have time for breakfast. Like that just doesn't happen. So there's no such thing as like, I need to, you know, I don't have time for a meeting or for phone calls or for this or for that. It's like my life has to revolve around the whole program. Like, where can I fit the program into my life? And if I don't put this program first, I'm going to lose everything that I have anyway. So what's the point?
I'm so glad that question was asked. And I hope it's okay in a format like this, usually when you're telling your story. I want to say that probably the biggest thing behind my relapses, apart from the fireworks of, you know, I was convicted of a felony, my family had me smuggling drugs when I was 8, like whatever, I got convicted in law school. Besides all the details, after 12 years of, you know, 2 years here, 1 year there, I discovered for me I couldn't stay stopped without Al-Anon, because I now can see every time I slip or eat something weird, it's preceded by an Al-Anon slip for me, because I don't know how to deal. The world and its people dominate me. I don't have boundaries. I cope with food. And so my bottom program now, when food's not in my head, I work the shit out of Al-Anon, because it keeps me away from the food and it brings me really close to God. And most of my sponsees end up there, I don't push them, but I do bring up a lot of times there's a parenting, job, husband behind the eating. And when you come out of the food, there's no skills to deal. That was a key for my relapse at about year 12 I joined. Thanks.
Thanks, you guys, both of those. Wow, great, great answers. And I would just add this then, which is, and I, yeah, absolutely agree with the Al-Anon. Control and fixing is a problem for me. I would say turn to page 52 every evening and check some of the key things. The opposite of those are the promises in step 9, page 83 and 4. And of course, the great promises in page, the 10th step promises in 84, 85. If you go to 52, it's really easy to start seeing a relapse. It goes like this. Do I think that the trouble in my personal relationships is someone else's issue? Do I think that I need to get control over my emotions and everybody else's? Am I prey to being a real miserable, depressed person? Am I having a real miserable time trying to make a life for myself? Or am I making a misery for life for others? You know, I just look at those things to check my own inventory. Do I feel useless even though I'm trying to be useful? It's not my fault. It's just simply, I better take that to my higher power. Because on my own power, the best I can come up with is going to be real misery thoughts that Stacey talked about, I think. You know, Cindy talked about, I'm going to have really negative stuff going down in my head. So I love that, Stacey, about the Al-Anon too, because it's like, yeah, that really addresses my need to be careful where I'm trying to control, fix, or change myself or others. That for me is the definite key, you know, starts taking me down. But remember, my last relapse, guys, was at the height of career, height of everything that ever happened to me. It looked peak. So the other stuff, which Cindy just said, I start thinking this and I start thinking that, and I haven't got time for this, and I'm too big for my boots or your boots. That stuff is so critical. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, this is a question from anonymous attendee. How do you discern God's will from your own?
For me, I feel like it's really easy to discern most of the time, because my will usually is something that might harm me or someone else down the road. And also, the way that I really discern my will and God's will is, if I'm really deep in my soul at peace with it, then it's probably God's will. Usually when I want to take an action, I'm very, very like, I have a lot of anxiety and I have this pit in my gut, and I'm just like really constantly worried about the outcome. And that is like red flags for me. And most of the time, if it's something that I know is God's will, it's something that's not going to harm me and not going to harm anybody else. And even if it's a chance that I'm taking, I usually feel like this sense of peace about it. I'm not like back and forth, like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And what if this happens? And what if that happens? It's just like this real peace, you know. And there's been times that I've been wrong about that, and I just look at those as like learning experiences. I mean, there was one time that I like moved, and I was absolutely convinced that it was God's will, because everywhere I turned, it was so easy. Everything just kind of fell in my lap. And it blew up in my face. Like, it was a horrible thing. Like, I almost lost my job. Like, my car got repoed. I broke my recovery. I fired my sponsor. I mean, obviously, it was like self-will and riot. But in the end, I just saw what a learning experience that was. So there are times that I make mistakes. But in general, when it's something that is going to be helpful to the world and not cause harm, and I feel peace about it, I mean, that's easy for me to see that that's God's will and not mine.
I have a huge ego and I'm all about Stacey, and the book has taught me and is teaching me as we go out from here, my only job is to be effective and useful. That's just not my nature. I'm loving it now. I know God's will usually. And also, P.S., it's super fun. It's not like join a club and get thinner. It's like walk with a bunch of friends around Green Lake, slowly. Have fun, help others. Also, I feel like I always know God's will. I just sometimes don't want to do it, but I'm not unclear about it. I just usually am like, no, I want to keep this case because I'll make money, even though I feel myself wanting to binge, let go of the case, you know? So yeah, it's super fun, effective and useful, helping others, like what was just said. It's good stuff. And it's like that prayer too. It's accept, love myself and help others. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much, guys. I would just add to that simple thing of, if the voice is really loud, it's usually me. And if it's really soft, it's usually my power. And if it's got tension and I'm feeling tight, that's me. And if it's in the flow and it seems like it's just coming through, I know that's the power. I don't think of myself separate from my higher power. I feel I am of the power. I am of God, of good. And that I have always been of that. And so my job only is to check it. Like, is it honest? Is it humble? And yeah, Cindy, what you're saying, you know, and in Stacy, you know, and is it useful? And I don't always check that, you know, because I want my way and I want it now. And I still suffer from grandiosity and defiance. And yeah, at page 84, it's going to tell us we're going to have some absurd thinking. And that's okay. I'm a recovered addict. But, you know, not all my mind got recovered. Remembering I'm recovered because I have recovered from a hopeless state of obsession and a hopeless state of craving. I don't have those, but like 0.02% of the time. And that's okay. That's normal. In fact, Dr. Bob had it for 2.5 years after recovery. But I'm looking at that, all that other stuff, the manageability, unmanageability, that stuff, tension, no tension, flow, tight. Check that.
Can I just add, you reminded me that thing they say, if it's urgent, it's probably not God's will. Like, I gotta do this now. Like, I keep wanting to buy a ticket to Mexico. It's like, no. And then when I have a moment, I'm like, no, don't be selfish. And the other thing is tradition one, unity. It took me till I got to Al-Anon. Apparently you're supposed to think of your loved ones. It's not just you. And early on, we were getting our first car and I wanted a convertible Volkswagen. We had two babies. And that's when my sponsor told me about unity. How's that working out for anyone else? And so it's like, okay. Unity, if you put the unity test through, it's usually really clear, like, oh, what about my husband? And no. Oh, yeah, no, that's all about Stacy.
All right. I can't believe I have been or ever will be abstinent, but I have lost weight recently, 50 pounds, but have still 121 pounds to go. Still in half measures, ?
Well, I think Cindy, probably the best person to answer here, but I wanted to say, it's not going to be about the weight, honey. The weight does come off. When you eat a meal plan that is just right for your body, it will come off. And look, I know that even in my younger days, I'm 58, but in the younger days, a pound a week was fantastic loss. For somebody of my size, when somebody's larger, sometimes it's 2 or 3 pounds a week. Only your body will know, and only your dietitian or nutritionist will know. Now, let's go beyond the pounds that need to come off. This program's forever. It's for a lifetime. If though that you're hearing a message of, when you say half measures, if the message you're getting and the approach to the steps that you're getting is not all about and profoundly clear about you finding and having the most incredible relationship with a power greater than you that you will depend on for life, in everything and always. If that message is not coming to you and it's all about this and that and the other, I go find the better message. Because once you get the message and you like the message, you'll probably want to do all the measures and not half the measures. A friend of mine, Terry, in program, she says, middle of the road solutions is like, if you hang out in the middle of the road long enough, you get run over. You know, we need to move to the edge. We need to go to the edge of where this program is profound.
Yeah, and just to reiterate that to me too, it has nothing to do with the weight at all. You know, I mean, I could go to Weight Watchers and lose weight. You know, I can try keto. I could do any diet plan out there and lose weight if that was my problem. Four different healthcare people suggested that I have the weight loss surgery, and I knew that the problem was my head. At that point, it was already in a way, and I knew that the problem was not in my stomach at all. And for me, like, my last relapse was a day and a half, because, and for me, like, I totally get the half measures thing, and, you know, we are where we are. For me, I had to get to the point where it was more painful to keep eating than whatever it was that I was trying to cover up with the food. Like, that was my gift of desperation, because I knew there was a solution. I felt it. I tasted it. I could not be oblivious out there in the world and pretend this program didn't exist anymore. And I was in these rooms. I never left, and I saw people recover, and I just could not, or was not willing to do it, or was not able to do it. And that was so painful to me that I reached the point 7.5 years ago where I was just done. You know, I was just, there was no question about it. And in a day and a half, I could not have done very much damage physically, but emotionally and spiritually, I was in so much pain. I became willing to do whatever it took. And that's really where my recovery began. And no one can tell us what's going to get to that point. You know, we each have to reach it on our own, and no one could have told me how to get there. Like, I can't explain it, but that's just what happened for me. And that's why they call it a gift of desperation. It really was.
I'm always told it's not about the weight, and good for you. And we get to be awesome, like right today, no matter what. That's what OA is about. We get to have a partnership with God that says, you are killing it. And also, an old friend used to say, if you want to lose 10 pounds, get ready to gain 15.
All right. This question is for Judith. I have a guy friend that is currently living and was born in the UK. I know that he has addictive tendencies, but he doesn't want to admit it. He's very stubborn. Do you think that his behaviors are something specific to a cultural thing in the UK, meaning with men in the UK, or do you think it could be just a personal thing?
Well, I'm not a psychiatrist or a therapist, and I really don't know what his behaviors are. And I couldn't really comment on that, to say you haven't really mentioned that. What I do know is that if people are displaying certain behaviors that seem compulsive, obsessive, and if they're related to an addiction, one can just simply do what we're instructed to do, which is, you know, to talk to them. Do I think anybody in the UK is different? No, I've been back here now years in Europe, and I'm from here originally. And no, we are all the same. I've certainly been to meetings in several countries around the world, and everyone's the same. But if your friend is not ready to admit, then there's not a whole lot you can do except hold up the mirror and go, hey, buddy, this is what you're looking like. Yeah. I'm not talking weight if he's a big man or something. I'm talking about behavior. You can just be honest with someone as much as we can, but love and tolerance is our code.
Thank you. Could Cindy talk about how she came to the place of accepting her post-weight loss body?
Yeah, I would just say just working the 12 steps. You know, it's all a process. The 12 steps have given me a different outlook on life, on everything. I used to be deeply ashamed of my body, but also the relationship that I have with the God of my understanding too. I've been able, like, I believe God has given me a gift of, like, humor, and I use humor in situations that might not be humorous to some people, you know, in order to get through that. And I remember you know, when my daughter was young, she would like play with my excess skin. And at one point, like I would accidentally put my arm up and it would slap me in the face and we would just keel over laughing. Like it's not something to be offended, you know? And then the moment, you know, I used to go to meetings and I would like cover up with jackets and stuff. And I started, I remember walking to a face-to-face meeting one time and I said, before I start, I'm going to take my jacket off and show you guys my body. And it just started from there. And today, you know, just knowing that there was three people, at least three, maybe even four, that came up to me off the street. The very first time it happened, I was actually in a bathing suit. I was at a water park and this woman walked up to me and was like, how did you lose weight? And I looked at her like she was insane. I had no idea that you can look at someone's body and know that they lost weight. And then, I don't know, I just started realizing after that, that what a beautiful gift. Like if I have the opportunity to share this program to a stranger on the street and save someone's life, who am I to say, you know, just from a little bit of shame, I can be proud of that. You know, this is just who I am. This is, I have scars and this disease has put me through hell. And that's a reminder of where I never wish to return.
Thank you. Stacy B, can you quickly list the descriptions of the rings of your success target?
Yes. For me, the bulimia is the center ring, and then which is keeping it down, and then sugar. You know, I can almost say almost all the rings are sugar, really, because that is like the main ingredient in alcohol. And it's just, it's like shooting up, you know, however I'm going to do it. So today, yeah, if I have something with gluten, white flour, or white rice, it's a slower sugar, but because my abstinence is quite clean, it's now I feel it. So yeah, it's the bulimia, it's the sugar, white flour. If I travel to India and all these wonderful places I do now, I can eat some of that and talk to my sponsor. But yeah, and it's different for everyone, although so many of us seem to be addicted to sugar. And I just read a book about the mouse doing the sugar thing till they die, like going to push that lever neurologically. It's bad juju. And over the whole thing, self-love and patience and just keep coming.
Thank you. Years ago, I had a great recovery. After 5 years, I relapsed. Because of my relapse, I had a lot of shame. I'm back in the program where I belong. Have any of the panelists had a problem with shame when they were in relapse?
Yeah, that's what was eating me. I was eating that and it was eating me. Shame is just, it's one of those constant old belief patterns that comes back up, especially when something has happened in the present. And that old belief can be removed through doing inventory. But yeah, the shame was, it was horrific. I used to sit in meetings, you know, I was the big check all the lists. I was doing it all. I was everything good. And then slowly but surely, you know, until you gain back all your weight, it's the most disheartening and shameful thing to sit in a meeting, not even be able to talk at some of those meetings because of there's no message to carry. And I know that now, like my higher power can handle that shame inside me. And so that, you know, just keep handling it over, because you have to just keep admitting I have no power over this shame either. Don't eat that for dinner.
Can I add, of course, I've heard shame stands for should have already mastered everything. And I talked a lot about step one, relapse. What I want to make sure people know is when you've got that elbow in the window, you get your butt 2 through 12, because my shame left after I did every single amends except the IRS. I haven't done yet, I'm thinking. Every single amends, that's when shame leaves. That's where the rubber hits the road. So got to get 2 through 12. And get to that good God love where you just want to go share what you've learned. And whoever it is, you know, we're all amazing today. We all have stuff to share.
I can't save my face and my ass at the same time is like what I like to remind myself, you know? And it is really shameful. I mean, I think of like, if I relapse right now, like, you know, I've spoken a lot, people know me, I put on workshops, which, I mean, that sounds very egotistical. Now that I'm thinking about it, God's like, that sounds like you're all full of yourself. But it would be very shameful to admit that. But why, you know, it's like to admit that I'm a compulsive eater, you guys know that. And I refuse, you know, I have hope here. If I leave, I'm dead. And I know this 100%. So it's like, I pray to God that my shame never keeps me out and it never keeps anybody else out either, because I cannot live and not be in this program regardless of how I feel.
One last thing I'd add to that too is that, you know, sometimes we have to relapse, some of us, just to get more humble. And that's all it is. I found out I just didn't have enough power. So either I had the power or I didn't have the power. And at that time, I didn't have the power. Don't be, you know, don't be kept in the prison, the box that we create for ourselves. Because the reality is, somebody said the other night in a meeting, a guy called Johnny B, he said, you know, it's really easy to get out of the prison that has no bars and no locks. And shame looks like a lock or a bar, but it really isn't. It's just simply, I just don't have the power. Give me more power, God, and show me how to get it.
I was going to say on my list that the program isn't linear. So if I relapse, I'm not back here. The program for me is a spiral upward. So as I found this program, you know, I was 21 and I had a lot of stuff still to do, including be convicted and learn all these things. Some people have to learn about sexual abuse, get out of a marriage. It is a spiral up. And so if I'm coming around again and I don't want to, but I'm still going up. I have relapsed with, you know, now I can practice law, even though I was never supposed to. I have kids, a house, and a husband. I'm still going up. And shame is, there can be embarrassment, but I've relapsed without shame now because I'm worthy and I'm doing my best.
All right. So this last question is, can one do the program if one can't get a higher power? Judith said it had to be for her a personal higher power. How does one get that?
I can just share briefly that for me, all I have to know is that there's a power out there and that it's not me. And if I know those two things, that, and I'm the person that's always searching for like this deep connection, like best friend God, I've always wanted that and I've not been able to find it. And I know some very, very deeply religious people who have this relationship where they like, you know, they're like best friends and God's like sitting on the couch with them. And sometimes they have harder times with this program than I do. So compare and despair, you know, it's like, I can't compare my higher power to someone else's. I do want that, but I talk to God all the time and I feel like I'm talking to the air. But I still talk to the air and I'm going to continue to talk to the air. You know, and when I'm in this room with you guys, when I'm sharing my story, when I'm with my fellows, I feel a power greater than myself like I've never felt it. So I know the existence of one. And I know lots of people who don't have a personal connection like that you're talking about. And it just works when we work it. We just keep taking these actions and it gives, I think I've had to change the way I feel about what that personal relationship looks like is really what it's about.
When I work with people who don't have that, and I don't have religion or anything like that, is I tell them just simply listen for the quiet voice within and then give it lots of space. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I define what is God, I've already limited what is God. As soon as I try to picture it or make it something there or that. So what I encourage is just simply, where's that little voice, that gentle voice that says, hey, Judith, don't do that right now. You know, that little voice that doesn't fight my ego, but simply says, hey, Judith. And that voice was where I found the power. And that voice has grown louder through meditation, which is just simply finding the unfamiliar, waiting for the unfamiliar. So create a space in your body where you can pause and wait and listen to the little voice.
In my big book, page 55, I was told by my sponsor, that's where to find God. And on there, it just talks about, you know, it's all deep within and we each have one. Also, when she took me through We Agnostics, this really changed my life. I kept thinking I would sit and become good and have a God or abstinent enough. She had me write action all over We Agnostics. Apparently, there's stuff you do. Pray to God and row to shore. Lastly, we had to put, can you see that back page? Okay, this is my back page of my big book. If you go through the book with someone or with the way my lineage does it, these are all the different gods in the big book. Anything that's capitalized, oh, yay, Judah, are the gods. And you get to choose. You can change it every day. Spirit of nature, universal mind, creative intelligence, mother of light. So it's a big old tent. And the last thing I'll say is I always get atheists for some reason. And every one of them is more spiritual than I am. And we have to go through all this, like, there's no God. I don't know why I get them. When I hear them share in meetings, they're still atheists and they're way more spiritual than me. So don't give up.
Thank you to our panelists and thank you to all of the audience too. Here are two noteworthy recovery resources available in Region 1. Virtual sponsors. Region 1 offers a matchup service for virtual sponsoring. Find out more on our website, oaregion1.org. Region 1 maintains a speaker list. Now that there is no travel barriers to meetings, how about bringing your experience, strength, and hope to a new meeting in Region 1? You can add your name if you are willing to speak, or you can request a copy of the speaker list. Check out how on the Region 1 website, oaregion1.org. We'd like to thank all the speakers and everyone who attended this workshop. We'll now close the meeting with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
I will not mind being done.